Members, we'll get started. Mr. Meyer, Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank
welcome.
You for the record. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me today Director Ed Bogus of our Fish and Wildlife Division and Jason Meckel from the Fish and Wildlife Division to review our hunting and fishing license initiative fee increases. After that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to bring up Colonel Conrad from our Enforcement Division to talk about our enforcement change items, one of which is a academy for new officers that we're seeking funding for, and then we will move into ecological resources and waters and talk about invasive species change items at that point and continue on with our change items from there. So, Mr. Chairman, without further ado, Mr. Ed Bogus.
Mr. Bogus, Director, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Ed Bogus from the Department of Natural Resources. I'm going to lead off with a little bit of an introduction about the Game and Fish Fund and the importance of the Game and Fish Fund to our division and our department, and then turn it over to Jason Meckel, who's been running our project to look at our fee structure and fees over the last several months. The hunting and fishing in Minnesota is big business. These are expenditure data from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's over a $3.6 billion expenditures for hunting and fishing in the state, and over 55,000 hunting and fishing supported jobs. And this is really the foundation of the work that we do. Game and Fish Fund supports all of our field staff in enforcement, fish and wildlife. This breaks down the expenditures proportionally, the revenue into the Game and Fish Fund. You can see that most of the revenue is from hunting and fishing license fees and stamps. We also get federal reimbursements from federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment. Those programs go back, in the case of hunting, to the 1930s, and in the case of fishing, to the 1950s. The reason that we're doing this project, the Game and Fish Fund, is in decline. Historically, we did hunting and fishing fee increases on about a six-year cycle. It's been 10 years since the last hunting and fishing general kind of a fee increase. We did some kind of smaller adjustments during the 2000s for some youth licensing, where we reduced the cost of some youth licenses and slightly increased some of the adult licenses, but there's not been a general change or adjustment in the Game and Fish Fund fees or the hunting and fishing license fees since 2001. We were able to continue to function and to keep up with inflation somewhat during that period due to higher than expected federal apportionments, because there were higher federal excise taxes collected on ammunition, guns, fishing and boating equipment. But we're currently in the fund, we're spending more than we're bringing in, and at this rate, the fund is projected to go, it can't go into the red, but it would be projected to go insolvent at the projected rates of projected revenue and expenditures sometime around the end of fiscal 14 or the beginning of fiscal 15. This could shift a year or so either way, depending on if revenues really come in at projected rates. We've been doing a lot the last several years to try to reduce expenditures. We've been looking at our fleet, where we've done a 10% reduction. We've gone to more fuel-efficient vehicles, less of the large four-wheel drive trucks, except where we absolutely need them. We've been holding vacant positions in both Fish and Wildlife and in the Enforcement Division with conservation officers. We've consolidated a number of our offices, and we're looking at doing more of that. We've done a number of operational efficiencies to try to improve our ability to get the job done better with less time and money. Use of technology is one of the big things where we're using a lot of these tough pad computers for fishery surveys, wildlife surveys. Eliminates the need to double enter data. Using a lot more private contract work for a lot of the development and maintenance work that we do. So we've been doing a lot, but we're still in a very dire situation as far as the health of the Game and Fish Fund. We'll talk specifically about some of the fees and license structure that we're looking at, but just as an example, if you look at what an annual fishing license cost in 1970 and what it cost in 2010 from $4 to $17, and then if that 2010 had been adjusted by the CPI, we'd be looking at about a $22.50 license, and that isn't much different than what we're proposing to go to in this initiative. And so you can see it's really not much different than what the inflation rate has been. Also, just in terms of Minnesota's license fees compared to other states, on fishing, we're in the bottom third or so of states, where we rank 36th nationally in the cost of an annual resident fishing license. I don't have the national numbers for hunting, but for deer hunting in the Midwestern states, I don't know if there's 10 states here, but we're near the bottom in the cost of an annual deer hunting license as well. So given all that and the importance of this fund to the work that we do, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bogus. I'm just going to bring the meeting officially to order. The Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee will come to order. Go ahead. Sorry, Mr. Bogus. Some of us don't get here by 8:15, so we have to formally do that when other folks
no
get
problem,
here.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Meckel, but I was just going to say that this Game and Fish Fund makes up over 80% of the operating budget of our division. It's really funds the foundation of the conservation work that we do for fish and wildlife in the state. It allows us to leverage the federal dollars to leverage and help to get the legacy dollars on the ground. So it's a crucial source of funding, and the health of the Game and Fish Fund is extremely important. So we put together a project to look at a variety of information we didn't want to just do a kind of a old traditional let's raise all the licenses by 15 or 20% type approach. We know that when we raise licenses, we have the potential to lose participation, so we wanted to understand what the customers want in a way that would allow us to structure licenses so that we could try to keep people involved in hunting and fishing and not drive people away with increased fees. So we've done a lot of kind of a business and marketing analysis on license structure and fees, and Jason Meckel has led that effort, and I'd like him to give you a little bit more background on that before we get into what we're actually proposing for fees.
Thank you, Director Bogus. We've got a couple questions first. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Director. When you went to the point restriction on the deer license, you know, the permits and hunting, there appeared to be a decrease in the amount of deer taken. If you went back to the previous, less restrictive taking of deer, would you see an increase in permits being applied for?
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, I'm not sure what happened with license sales in what we call Zone 3 down in the southeast part of the state. I know that deer harvest did decline, and that was expected, particularly on the buck harvest that first year. The antlerless harvest actually went up a little bit. We do expect that buck harvest to come back up because a lot of those deer that couldn't be shot this last year will be able to be shot this next year. So we knew there would be this sort of one-year depression of buck harvest, but I'd have to look at the license sales to see if those were affected, and I can't answer that right now.
Follow-up, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner. With the CWD, when they did the intensive aerial surveillance and count, they were surprised at the quantity of deer And I was wondering if that, you know, would go into the equation of trying to increase the harvest in that whole zone.
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, yeah, we were surprised at the density of deer in some of those areas, particularly around some of that core area. Overall, the density was higher than expected, but it was not, you know, it was maybe 20% higher than what we thought it had been. But I think, as you know, we'll definitely be looking at that area where the CWD positive deer was to do something different there that will definitely be designed to increase harvest. And we would also try to take what we learned from there to see if we need to do things differently in the rest of the zone. But right now, we haven't had time to really analyze that and make any decisions.
Representative Drazkowski, is your question to this point? Representative Drazkowski.
It is, Mr. Chair. I think it may have been answered. Mr. Bogus, just curious if you've looked at the densities throughout the rest of southeastern Minnesota. I know that I've experienced and seen similar levels of deer pressure all the way to the Mississippi River, and wondering if we're going to liberalize deer harvest instead of restricting it.
Director Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, we've been doing surveys to calculate deer densities throughout all the permit areas in southern Minnesota. We haven't done any as intensive as what we just did in the CWD area. So actually, our antler point restriction is designed over the long term to increase harvest just by requiring people to put more emphasis on taking antlerless deer, which is much more important to controlling deer populations than taking a bucks. We haven't, you know, the antler point restriction was a 3-year kind of a pilot to see and evaluate whether that's a way we want to go in the future, whether hunters like it, whether landowners like it. So we haven't made any long-term commitments, and as far as what we're going to do this fall, definitely we're going to do something different around those permit areas. In fact, we'll probably create a new permit area for the area around Pine Island. But beyond that, I guess I don't know yet what we're going to do.
Thank you, Director. And members, this is good discussion. It centers around how much the fees need to be increased and the cost of CWD and all that. But we'll make an effort to keep the policy discussions, if they don't center around money, which oftentimes they do, to later on as we work on our budget. But those are good questions, and Director, thanks for those answers. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, you mentioned something in passing about the Game and Fish Fund supporting or having an increased use supporting legacy funds. So is it correct then that this is a new pressure that's put on the Game and Fish Fund, that there's additional activities that are being used to support legacy projects or applications?
Mr.
Director
Bogus. Representative Hansen, we made a commitment to help get those legacy funds on the ground, and so we've asked a lot of our staff to work with partners, even though they're not being compensated out of the legacy account. We are tracking that. We are starting to ask for some of that funding now out of legacy, but a lot of the projects, even that come in from outside partners, rely heavily on our field staff for technical support in designing good projects and managing good projects. So, and we're having fewer and fewer of those people available just due to the budget pressures, inflationary pressures, and so forth, to be able to support those kinds of projects. So if we can get this initiative, we'll be able to fully staff our field stations, and they'll be able to work with those partners to make sure that we're doing good projects. We are, as I said, we are tracking any legacy work that we do, and we're going to the council and asking for future appropriations to support that work. But without those field staff doing the work that can't be done with the legacy work, with the legacy funds, the population work, surveys, and things like that, we just can't deliver good conservation.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and I think you might have answered a little bit of this, Mr. Bogus, but you cost code your time, correct? So if someone comes in and wants some help on a legacy project, that's going to show up on a timesheet to the Game and Fish Fund. Are you able to show us an aggregate amount of how much Game and Fish Fund money has been spent on legacy dollars?
Director Boggess.
Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, we could provide that.
Thank you, Representative Director Boggess, for that short answer. I appreciate that. Any follow-up, Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, I think this is important because we've had a lot of discussion about supplanting, you know, that we would be having legacy funds replacing additional funds, but here we have testimony that says that legacy funds are actually causing increased spending out of the funds. And those, I think that work should be funded out of legacy dollars, and that the legislature should make those decisions, make sure that there's correct cost accounting for that work.
And that's a good point, Representative Hansen. That does go both ways. And I'll remind members and the DNR that the legacy is going to move through Representative Erdahl's division, so we will not discuss the legacy part of the budget until that bill comes before us, the actual presentation of the budget and the DNR's request and such. It may show up in our budget books because it will be here, but the actual presentation of that is more appropriate than in the division as we utilize our time. Continue, Director Boggess.
At this point, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Mr. Meckel.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, Jason Meckel, Division of Fish and Wildlife.
Go ahead, Mr. Meckel.
Back in June, we formed a project team to take a comprehensive look at our license structure and prices. And what we tried to do was bring as much information into this process as we could to really thoroughly analyze this and develop a system that we think will better serve Minnesotans going forward, particularly hunters and anglers. And what we did initially was to meet with the Budgetary Oversight Committee, and we set out to decide, if we're going to provide some solutions to this issue, what are the key values? What are the things that we need to make sure we satisfy in this process? And obviously, long-term stability of the Game and Fish Fund was one of the values that the Budgetary Oversight Committee has emphasized and certainly is important for our work. We also wanted to address this issue of a fish and wildlife expenditure balance. This has been something that the BOC has flagged for a number of years, essentially saying we would like fishing license revenue to cover the cost of fisheries-related management and enforcement activities. We would like hunting license revenue to cover the cost of hunting-related management and activities. And currently, the imbalance is the fisheries stuff is supported by about $4.3 million of hunting revenue. We also wanted to make sure that we had a customer-friendly structure and that it provided good value. And some of the things we talked about in terms of a customer-friendly structure is one that is conducive to recruitment and retention. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about the work that we did to understand our customers. We also wanted to make sure that we did not leave any federal dollars on the table in this process. We have excise taxes on the equipment we all buy. When we recreate, those excise taxes come back to the state through these federal aid grants, but it's tied to, in part, the number of licensees that we have. So the more licenses we sell that we can certify, the more of that federal money we get back. And for a fishing license, it's about $7 per license. And then, as Director Boggess was talking about, we need to have the capacity to manage and improve the opportunities for these high-quality experiences that we currently enjoy in this state. And these were all the values that our stakeholders throughout the summer and the BOC endorsed and said were important for us to address. There's trade-offs associated with this, and we'll talk a little bit about that in terms of the solutions. But one of the things that we wanted to emphasize for folks is that hunters and anglers today are not the same as they were 20 and 30 years ago. The reality is that a lot of us don't hunt and fish every year. Many of us do, but as these data on this slide show, 32% of our anglers will buy a license just once in 5 years, while only 27% of our anglers are buying a fishing license in five years. We don't think it's because they're illegally fishing in those off years. It's just the reality we have a lot of busy people, a lot going on, and we've become a more urban population over this time frame. We hired some outside expertise to help us survey Minnesota licensed buyers and find out what kind of a structure would better serve them. This is just one graphic that illustrates this difference between people who, what we call more avid or regular, people that are buying 5 out of 5 years versus those that would buy a license 2 out of 5 years or 3 out of 5 years. Those are identified on this chart as your casuals versus your regulars. And one of the things that we found is casual anglers and casual hunters in the survey identified these more short-term kinds of fishing licenses to be a better fit for them. They would be very desirable. So this just illustrates that we've got very different market segments. Of the over 2 million people that fish in this state, not everybody wants a license that's the same. Currently, we basically have two options, a 24-hour license or an annual fishing license. So ultimately, our proposed changes can be summarized this way. We've proposed half-priced youth licenses across the board. For any fishing and hunting licenses, whatever youth would buy would be half the price of an adult license. We've also proposed some lower cost options for those more casual participants. The examples I would point to would be like the 3-day license, a 90-day license, that type of thing. And then the other thing that we've heard from stakeholders is, for those of us that do a lot of outdoor recreating, we buy a lot of stamps, we buy a lot of licenses, can you package it all up into one thing? And that's what we're calling this convenience packages. So that's what's in this package. I want to emphasize that all of these prices were based on this research, on economic studies, elasticity analysis of what would happen to sales if the price increased. And finally, the outcome from this proposal is that we get some new revenue that will help us fund conservation delivery. I know we're pressed for time, so I'm just going to highlight a couple of things on the handouts that you have. We've kept our two most popular licenses. That's the individual angling and the husband and wife combination angling. We've increased the price a modest amount. We've added a 90-day angling opportunity for those folks who would be more price sensitive and may decide not to buy a license. This is a more affordable option, as well as a 3-day opportunity. You can see the youth price, 16, 17-year-olds, would go to $12. And we've also proposed to separate a spearing and angling license requirement. Currently, if you're a dark house spear, you have to have an angling license. Under this proposal, you could choose to have one or the other, both if that's what you like to do. And finally, we've proposed to try to reduce the complexity and also address some confusion, the elimination of the conservation license. We haven't sold very many of those, and we think this structure better fits what the customers really want, something oriented around the number of days that they participate. For non-residents, we're adding a 7-day family opportunity. We want to try to encourage and have affordable option for families to come spend some time at Minnesota Resorts hospitality industry. We've been seeing a gradual decline in the number of non-residents coming to Minnesota and angling. We'd like to see if we can stabilize that and reverse that trend with some changes to our licenses. And then again, some price increases that were based on studies that we had done. Our innovative licenses for the hunting side is that there is some interest among casual hunters in a short-term opportunity. For many folks, they just don't get the chance to go out very many weekends during the year. And what we've seen in discussions with stakeholders is they see some real value in a 3-day small game license. You could pheasant hunt or duck hunt, grouse hunt on that 3-day license at a very affordable price. You would not have to purchase any additional stamps, so $19 and you're done. The only one you would have to purchase would be a federal waterfall stamp. There's nothing we can do about that one. Again, youth licenses, 50% discount. And then generally speaking on our hunting licenses, we didn't need to generate as much revenue, and we were able to look at basically a 15% increase on most licenses. On non-residents, we've also proposed a similar 3-day concept, and then across-the-board price increases. We don't sell very many non-resident hunting licenses, about 20-some thousand a year, compared to the 300,000-plus non-resident angling licenses. Convenience packages that we've proposed is we currently have a sports license. That's your small game and your angling license. What we're proposing is to bundle up what a lot of our folks buy, and that is angling, trout stamp, small game, plus a pheasant, duck stamp, and then a deer privilege. You could buy all that in one fell swoop for $99. Simple, easy convenience package. And then we'd make that available as the husband and wife version for $125. So if you will look at where we are nationally, Director Bogus showed that we're 36th in the nation on price. This proposal would move us to 19th. We'd still be in the middle of the pack. We're a top 5 destination state. We have the 5th most number of angling days in the country. The only states that beat us are the coastal states, Florida, Texas, Alaska, California. For an inland fishery state, we're number 1 at an affordable price. If you look at how we compare to other Midwest states, we're currently below Wisconsin. This proposal would move us above Wisconsin on price, but just below South Dakota. Our non-resident licenses under this proposal would go from 37th to 25th. There's a lot of price sensitivity around non-resident licenses. There's a lot of competition for bringing those folks in the state. And even though we are a top destination state, we've seen this decline. So we want to be careful that we don't shoot ourselves in the foot with our pricing structure. Overall, this generates just about $10 million in new fishing revenue and about $4.5 million in new hunting license revenue. This proposal does stabilize the Game and Fish Fund. You saw the uptick in the balance in our projections. It does address the Fish and Wildlife expenditure balance. It is a more customer-friendly structure and offers value. It maintains our ability to maximize federal dollars, and it gives us the capacity to provide high-quality hunting and fishing that citizens in this state expect. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meckel. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, could you clarify for me with the new structure, somebody who wants to do both spearing and angling, how that fits into the picture and what the changes are there?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, the structure changes that we've heard from Dark Horse Spears that they actually don't angle, but currently they have to have an with a hook and line, and they currently have to have an angling license. And what they've suggested is analogous to, you know, deer licenses where you have different deer licenses, different deer seasons, or small game and trapper licenses, that you can have a Dark Horse spearing license if that's all you do. And under this proposal, what we do is separate that from the angling license and then just charge an $18 fee for a Dark Horse spearing license. It's equivalent to the price of a 90-day license, which is what our new structure has, and that's about the length of a Dark Horse spearing season, 90 days.
Follow-up. Representative Torkelson.
But for someone who does both, how does the fee structure change for someone who does both spearing and angling?
The fee
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, the fee structure doesn't change for somebody who does both other than the price goes up. The angling license goes up to $24. They currently are spending $17 for a spearing license, $17 for an angling license. So they're spending $34. Under this proposal, they'd be able to do both activities for $42.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, earlier in your career, you worked in Dakota County on the Vermilion River. In your professional experience, do you think these shorter 3-day or 7-day licenses would attract tourism for folks to come into the Twin Cities area from out of state to do fishing in the Vermilion area?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, our non-resident licenses currently allow people for a 3-day, 24-hour, 7-day, 14-day, and full-year license. Non-residents have a lot of options. The proposal for residents is to add a few more options for our residents. I don't know that we could speculate that it would increase tourism into specifically Dakota County. The trout stream you're talking about is a fantastic resource. It's kind of a quiet gem. But
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be for folks who are of limited means more likely for them to go fish coming from the inner city to come out and hunt and fish in the Vermilion?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, that is in part what motivated us in this structure is that people who may be just very casually interested in fishing but don't want to spend the full amount of a full-year license, for example, want to try it out. The survey and analysis that we did is that there are very different demographic markets. Urban anglers, more casual, and we think this license will actually result in more sales over the long haul because it will provide a short-term opportunity for residents that doesn't currently exist.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Meckel. I'm referring to slide number 11, at least on our sheet, it's slide number 11. It's the anglers and hunters today, the number of years licensed out of 5 years, that slide. And I see that there's a decline, you know, obviously, particularly in fishing. And I'm just wondering what those statistics looked like 10 or 15 years ago and how that's affected the population of fish.
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Scott.
Representative Scott, thank you. We don't have a lot of historical data of this type. We've only had electronic licensing for about 10 years or so. It used to be the old paper version. That's one of the benefits of the new system is it allows us to look at our customers in a much different way. Many businesses would be envious of that. Our overall number of anglers in this state is holding steady. We're actually seeing a slight increase in the number of resident anglers, while we're seeing a slight decrease in the number of non-resident anglers. But overall, for the last 10 or 15 years, we're pretty steady. Nationwide, there is an overall decline, but Minnesota is holding our own. So in terms of how that's affecting fishing, the things that would be affecting fishing is the fact that we're just getting a little bit better at fishing with all the technology that we have.
That was that discussion yesterday about the bobber and the cane pole and modern technology. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Mr. Meckel. Mr. Meckel, the early discussion you had about the federal dollars that come in with each license purchase, have you done any modeling? Obviously, license fees are going to go up, and I know that you've looked at packaging them in ways that look like they might, or at least the hope is that it will help market these licenses in a way that they wouldn't by themselves. But the reality is that the consumers out there do know how much they spend on licenses and will still look at things closely. Have you modeled if we have a decrease in the number of licenses that are purchased, how is that going to affect our federal revenue?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, we did look very closely at that, and that was really one of the motivators for why we wanted to take a close look at the price sensitivity of each of these licenses. For each of these licenses, we have some data that suggests that at a certain price, here's the decline in sales that we might project. Now, we've introduced these other lower-cost options as a way to mitigate that, and we did it based on what we think from the survey work that customers will buy. So we've projected that we think we can retain the current number or increase the number of licenses we sell. Difficulty is we're introducing some new products to the market, essentially, and until we get some experience with those licenses, we won't know exactly or be able to estimate exactly what's going to happen in terms of license sales, but our projections are that we will retain and maintain our federal grant dollars capacity through this proposal.
Follow-up,
Mr.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Meckel, like the one license where you package the small game and the fish and the trout stamp and the deer all together, does just that packaging of those doesn't disadvantage us in getting those federal dollars in? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Draskowski, it does not disadvantage us. The way that works for federal aid, basically it's the angling license and the hunting license that we sell. When we package them, in this case, we'll get to count that as both angling and a hunting license for federal aid purposes and get the full reimbursement back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wagenius.
Mr. Chair, I don't know which of you would be better to answer this question, but as I'm hearing about the short-term licenses, particularly the fishing licenses, I'm wondering how you would be working with your colleagues in Parks and Trails to make an experience, both coming to Parks and Trails and going fishing at the same time, maybe camping out or whatever. Do you have a strategy there?
Ms. Director Bogus, if you could talk about the program that the parks use,
Mr.
and
Chair,
how else you can expand on it.
Wagenius, we actually started a program with our Parks and Trails Division a couple of years ago to allow people to fish for free if they're in a park. So this won't really affect fishing that's going on in parks. We do have an initiative that we'll be bringing forward this year to clarify that also applies to ice fishing, because we kind of missed that when we did that initiative. So, sure. But we are looking at a lot more activities in parks with Minocqua and equipment available at the parks and getting people into the parks as a gateway to getting into fishing.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was the gateway issue I was trying to get at. I understood about the free fishing in the parks, but packages where you come to a park, you have your reservation, you have your fishing license. So these packages are just for licenses. I was looking at a broader type of experience or package that DNR could offer, not just on the licenses.
Mr. Chair and
Director
Wagenius, Yeah, we're working with Parks and Trails. They're like I say, they've got equipment available in a lot of the parks. We have people going in there and doing fishing instruction. We feel we could do a lot more of that in a lot more parks and at a lot larger scale. And it's not only a gateway to fishing, but it gets people into the parks as well. And so we think it's a win-win to encourage that sort of packaging of those programs.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel is one of the few people around the table here that are considered seniors. The only place I see senior mentioned is in a small game, 65 and over. You know, I know we're interested in trying to retain people that are fishing and hunting, and also attract new people into the arena, so to speak. And I've had some comment from citizens. Have we ever considered a reduced fee for over 65 or over 70, or fees that would, I think, maybe encourage the senior citizen to continue the hobby that he is engaged in? Were any of those things considered at all? Or?
Director Boggess, real short, the history of when you had free, how it's real quick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hancock, there used to be a senior fishing license that was discontinued about 10 years or so ago. And one of the things we've seen is actually a lot of our senior citizens, which is, of course, is one of our largest growing demographics that we have, spend a lot more time fishing than some of the younger anglers do. And many of them, you know, have the means and all of that to do it. And so offering those discounted licenses costs a lot of money and would cost even more in the future. And we have some lower cost options in this package if it's an economic issue for a senior citizen, but we didn't propose going back to that system in this package.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, you gave us the trends in angling licenses. What about the same thing for hunting? Deer licenses, pheasant stand, duck stamps the last 10 years or so. What are the trends in terms of hunting in the state?
Mr. Meckel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, in Minnesota, our hunting licenses have been holding their own again compared to national trends. Nationally is on a decline, even more so than on angling for hunting licenses, but Minnesota has been holding pretty steady. Our small game licenses fluctuate a little bit more depending on pheasant habitat, pheasant populations, and grouse habitat, but our deer licenses remain very strong.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel, Mr. Boggess, thanks for being here. I have a couple of questions on the excise tax. Can you give me a little clarity? What's the percentage that we pay, and then the number of dollars that leave the state and then come back to the state? Is that
Director Boggess, remind the committee what the excise tax is and what it's charged on.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, the excise tax is federal excise tax on arms and ammunition, fishing equipment. I want to say it's 10 or 11% federal excise tax. How much of that is collected in Minnesota, I don't know off the top of my head, but all of those federal excise taxes obviously are collected nationally, go into, there's a Pittman Robertson for the hunting side, and then there's Dingell Johnson, Wallop Brough, which were the congressional acts for the fishing side, and then those are apportioned back to the states for the Pittman Robertson. It's apportioned 50-50, 50% the land area of the state, 50% the number of individuals who are licensed to hunt in the state. And then for fishing, it's 60-40, with 60% based on the licenses and 40% on the land area, if I'm recalling it correctly. So we get money apportioned back to us out of that federal excise tax, and it's been running in the range of about $25 million a year that's coming back to Minnesota out of those federal excise taxes on arms and ammunition and fishing equipment sales.
Follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Boggess, could you get that number for us, please, that the number of dollars that do leave our state?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, we can certainly see if that number is available.
Okay, thank you. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meckel and Director Bogus, actually this would probably be for Mr. Meckel. I was intrigued by your graphs on the license fees.
Representative Draskowski, which page are you on?
I'm on page 10, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And the whoever does these graphs is very good at what they do. I really appreciate them. But the question is this. We, as you look at those states, and I've been in a number of those states, I'm not aware of any that have additional taxes like we do in Minnesota. We've got a heritage, an outdoor tax that brings in about, at least for this the game and fish area, about $80 or $90 million a year. And then we've got about $26 million, as I understand, that comes out of the LCCMR dollars that is directed to many of these same areas. Are you aware of any other states that have those types of taxes that enhance these areas arguably 3, 4, 5 times as much as the Game and Fish Fund does here in Minnesota?
Director Bogus or Mr. Meckel?
Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, there are some other states that have something similar to our legacy amendment. Missouri was the first. Arkansas has one. Those are the only ones I'm aware of. They're the money, the Environmental Trust Fund money that LCCMR kind of oversees comes from the state lottery. So it's not like a tax per se. And I know a number of states have various lottery funds that a portion of which go to the environment. So there are some, but it isn't real common across the country.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Vargas.
Thank you, Representative Draskowski. Members, I'm just going to take an opportunity here. I believe there's some of the resorters, and they've got appointments throughout the day. I think they may want to comment. So if somebody from the resort is interested in commenting on the proposed fee increases, if they wanted to come forward, that'd be great. Just give us a short comment. And then if there's any other members, as long as the resorters are coming forward and the public interested in this issue, they could come forward. Welcome to the committee. Welcome to your day at the Capitol. And if you could identify yourself for the record, Mr. Frost, if you want to go there and sit alongside. We're going to leave room. There's a third chair. Mr. Meyer's going to need to join you because I'm going to have a question in regards to an issue you guys are working on. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Hey, I'm Jack Frost, Beltrami County Commissioner, resort owner in the Bemidji area. I do know that predominantly a lot of our business does come from out of state. That is a concern to the extent of what I see as double-digit increases to the non-resident licensing fee. I know I do get, because I sell a lot of fishing licenses, I am a DNR licensed provider of fishing licenses, and I'm getting a little sticker shock now at the current rates, and I see, you know, the non-resident angling individual up 10%, non-resident angling 72 up 25%, 50% for the 24-hour. Those kinds of numbers scare me a little bit. And also, it was alluded to previous in testimony that some of these folks aren't coming anymore. And we're trying to, yes, encourage younger people to come. And we sure do appreciate the in-state business that we do get. But a predominant, you'd be surprised how much new money comes into our local marketplace because of out-of-town tourists. And they would be non-residents, of course.
Thank you.
That would be my immediate concern.
Thank you, Commissioner. Comment, sir?
My name is Dave Thompson. I own Fisherman's Village Resort in Battle Lake area. I'm part of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. I served for 9 years on the Citizen Oversight Committee for the Game and Fish Fund and the Fisheries Division, so I have a great deal of experience on fisheries funding. Part of the reason why we're here, I believe, raising fishing license fees today is because prior to 2000, the general fund had over $5 million in the fisheries budget, and over the past 11 years, that's dwindled down to $0 that goes into the fisheries budget. And so now the fisheries budget is totally funded by user fees. Yet it creates a huge benefit to the state residents, even if they don't fish, hunt, or recreate in any way. The amount of money and recreation time that's spent on Minnesota waters is in the billions of dollars, and it benefits every state resident in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Anything further you wanted to add?
I covered some things with DNR in the last couple of days that we felt were problem areas in.
And what would they be?
Some lines. We felt the 7-day non-resident license needed to come back. It was deleted. It's one of the most popular licenses I sell because most Minnesota non-resident customers that come for 1 week. Some come for a little beyond that. So the 3-day and the 7-day licenses are quite important, and they've agreed to put that back in.
Mr. Thompson, do you have any issues with thoughts of the DNR putting Wi-Fi in camper cabins?
Yes, we have some serious concerns about what we consider state-sponsored tourism. The state parks are expanding the use of state parks, and rightfully so. We have some gems out there in state parks. But
thank you, Mr. Thompson. I just wanted to excuse me. Were you done?
I just wanted to say that these camper cabins had originally supposed to have been like wooden tents, but now we're adding heat and electricity and even Wi-Fi to those camper cabins, and then the private enterprises around state parks are losing business until those state park cabins are filled.
Well, Mr. Thompson, I guess we have a little bit of a difference of opinion, as Representative Kahn and I both slept in separate camper cabins in 2003 when I was the chief author of the bill that we negotiated with the resorters to allow DNR to build rustic camper cabins. I didn't envision them having Wi-Fi. Mr. Meyer is nodding his head that he's hearing what I'm saying. I'm expecting that we'll have further discussions, but I did not envision them including Wi-Fi, and I hope the DNR gets the message. They weren't wooden tents. They did have lights and heat in them, even the rustic ones that we continue to do, and I appreciate you guys working together on that issue. It was one of the things I wanted to address here. So, members, thanks for giving me the liberty to bring that one up. I thought we should hear that because it's an important issue, especially in Representative Purcell, Representative Fabian, Representative Hancock's area, where these resorters are really important. Mr. Frost, I've actually been out to your resort. You have a beautiful resort. You do a good job. You pay taxes. It's private property. We appreciate that, and we understand that competition from the government is challenges for you. Thanks for your comments on the fishing license. If you could stay there just for a second, if any of the members have questions for either of the resort owners. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Director Bogus, appreciate the liberty to bring them down. I know they have a busy day with appointments throughout the legislature. We are back. We have Representative Purcell had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, it's kind of a follow-up on some of the discussion earlier, and maybe just to add on to some of this about the fee increases and the competition that we do have for with some of our surrounding states. And I just wanted to comment that I think that the resident individual fishing license fees increases certainly will not be helpful to us, I don't believe. And we see a lot of around the Bemidji-Cass Lake area just dozens and dozens of Dakota plates, pick a south or a north. But I think it's very important that we maintain this this competitiveness, and I just want to make sure I'm on the record on that. So thank you.
We're glad, Representative Purcell, that you're advocating for your folks. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to mention Representative Juskowski brought up the tax that provided the money for the LCCMR. It's not actually a tax. That's just lottery money where people choose to play the lottery. I don't play the lottery. I've never put any money into that fund.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Juskowski.
Mr. Chair, thanks, Representative Wagenius. I guess after a while, all the different funds of taxes just run together for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Was that the? Was there more, Director Bogus?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to call the committee's attention to the other sheet that we passed out that has the detailed breakdown of current fees and proposed fees, and just to represent Purcell's point, Mr. Meckel mentioned that the non-resident licenses are very price sensitive, and we did not propose a similar kind of proportional increase on those. They have been raised some in the past for some invasive species work, and there's a proposal again this year to do that. But proportional to the resident licenses, we did hold those increases down. But it's a good point, because they are, those non-resident license sales are very sensitive to price.
Well, and Director Bogus, the idea behind the AIS fee on the non-residents is they bring their boats with them, but it's a challenge for us to be able to tax their boats. But we can tax, increase their fishing license, because we're going to, there's going to be a proposal to increase the fee on Minnesota boats, but it's not practical on the non-residents. So some folks may ask why that fee's that way. Director Bogus, I do have a question. I was hoping Representative Hansen was still here, but do you intend to continue with the not-so-successful deer donation program? And it's not, I don't mean this negatively to Representative Hansen. It was a program that he brought forward, and it sure sounded good at the time, but unfortunately, we had the whole issue of lead in deer, and it's really caused, making it a real challenge to do this program. Are you continuing with that program? Do you have any changes that you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, you're correct. It's been a challenge with the concerns about lead in venison and the additional screening that we've had to do in distributing that venison. But we have nothing in any of our packages this year that would change that program.
Thank you, Director Bogus. Or Mr. Meyer, do you have numbers that show what the anticipated drop-off is if you have this 40% increase in resident fishing licenses?
Mr. Chair, our assumptions based on our market research are that we're going to lose some annual license sales, but based on that, what they call that churn that Mr. Meckel showed, where a lot of people are buying 1 out of 5, 2 out of 5, 3 out of 5, very few are buying licenses every year. We've offered some shorter term 90-day, 7-day, 1-day options, where if they buy any of those, they still count for federal reimbursement under that excise tax apportionment formula. And our assumption is that they won't drop out entirely. They'll switch to a lower cost license.
Director Bogus, that was my second question. The feds have a program for that $7 reimbursement on fishing licenses, or if somebody buys a 3-day, do you get the whole $7?
Mr. Chair, if they buy any of those licenses, they count as a licensed angler for purposes of the formula for our apportionment. It doesn't have to be an annual license.
So, Director Bogus, if you sell a 1-day license, you get as much if you sell. Well, you're using some of the same, Director Bogus, you're using some of the same innovation that we use, or that my colleagues use in Health and Human Services to, I'm trying to use my words carefully here, to help the federal government increase their ability to borrow money. So, thank you. Next, I think, Mr. Meyer, do we have enforcement next to talk about the shortage of COs?
Related to this proposal, we have several proposals within our enforcement change items, and I'm bringing up with Colonel Conrad to speak on those issues. You can see here the enforcement budget, as we spoke of yesterday, is really driven by the Game and Fish Fund, the General Fund, small piece of the Natural Resources Fund, and Special Revenue Funds. And as we spoke of in detail, the work of our complement of enforcement is driven by the funding source. We do have several strategic objectives that we talked about. And the change item that I have Colonel Conrad here to talk about today is our Conservation Officer Academy proposal to bring us back to full complement. And I will let Colonel Jim Conrad speak about that.
Colonel, welcome to the committee.
For the record, Jim Conrad, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. And this proposal would fund an additional 8 officers in FY12 and an additional 12 officers in FY13 to bring us basically, or to keep us basically where we are at right now, which is 25 vacancies out of a complement of 111. As you can see from the funding splits there, that there would be no general fund portion of that funding. It would all come from dedicated funds. As I talked before, there are currently 25 vacancies. We anticipate an additional 16 over the next biennium, and this would keep us at the current level of vacancies. We're looking at filling vacancies that are out there based on resource activity and population, as well as requests for service. And this particular proposal is linked to the revenue enhancement and conservation delivery change item that Director Bogus just talked about, because of its drain on the Game and Fish Fund.
Thank you. Is that everything, Colonel?
That's everything.
Okay, thank you. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this question on behalf of Representative Cornish, and the rationale for not bringing it back to full complement, because I'm thinking in 06, didn't we bring it back up to full complement when we did the last academy?
Mr. Chair, we were for a few weeks at full complement. Actually, they counted the officers who were in training at the time. And by the time that they completed their training, we had had several more retirements, and the actual feet on the ground, fully trained field officers never actually hit that 211.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lagunas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to ask the question that you are expecting me to ask, and that is, in the last academy, how many women did you have? What proportion of women, what proportion of people of color did you have?
Colonel Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ogenius, as we discussed, I think, in the last budget session, that academy, which was 3 years ago, was all male.
Follow up, Representative Ogenius. Colonel, did you have something?
Oh, yes, yeah. We're going to follow up.
Yep.
Thank
Representative
Ogenius. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this coming academy?
Mr.
Colonel
Chair,
Conrad.
Representative Wagenius, without having started that process of hiring, I can't tell you. All that I can tell you is that the percentages of people of color and female candidates are just not there.
Follow up, Representative Wagenius.
Yes, and so one has to ask why they're not there, and because two things. I mean, one, I think everybody around this table would acknowledge that these are good-paying jobs with great prestige. So women like good-paying jobs with good prestige, and so do people of color. So what is the stumbling block that keeps them out?
Colonel Conrad, comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I wish I knew so that we could address that issue. We, in the past, have done our best to recruit from those protected classes and have just not seen an increase in the number of candidates from those classes. And I think that is something that is also experienced by law enforcement, other law enforcement agencies in the state.
If I could, Representative Wagenius, Colonel Conrad, the CO, I know you're going to keep going, Representative Wagenius, the CO at the lake where our cabin is a female, and I'm thinking of another one that is near home. How many are? But I also noticed, I will say, in Outdoor News that two of your recent promotions were white males, and they were replacing female retirees. So I'm wondering, evidently you've had a long history of having females involved because they were retiring. And can you get back to Representative Wagenius and I the compliment of how many COs are? And that would be good for us to know, because it does add a great face to them working together, and as we try to help and recruit a more. And as a matter of fact, Conservation Officer Hine, am I pronouncing that right, who was in the Hastings area for a number of years,
is a minority. I often thought he was Hmong, but if I'm not mistaken, that's not the case, though it worked real well with the Hmong community because he passed for that, and with his name he could have been, so it reached out well, and I can't remember what his background or his ethnic background is. Representative Wagenius, back to you. If you want to make a comment, Colonel, and then I want Representative Wagenius to be able to continue.
Mr. Chair, I will comment to the fact that when I was hired in 1983, we had two female officers, and one of those left the first couple of years that I was here. That was back in the 80s. Since then, we have quite a few number more. I can't give you an exact amount, but I would guess it's around 20. So 10% of our complement. In the recent promotions that you talked about, we also had one female officer that was promoted to a lieutenant's position.
Well, Colonel, I'll make sure that Mr. Albert from Outdoor News gets her picture in there, too, because I didn't see that. If I did, I apologize to her. I missed it. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that other enforcement agencies are having the same problem. But some of them are being more successful. So I hope, and I more than hope, you should be talking to Minneapolis, who has been more successful than you, which has to be a total oddity for me, because I would think that your job pays more and your job is more prestigious. So why would Minneapolis be more successful? We have to answer that question before we go forward with the new academy, from my point of view. Okay, that's one issue. You talk about, I mean, we talk about all the money we spend. We want to have measurable outcomes. What would be the measurable outcome that we would have if we had another academy and added to your complement? Would it be fewer lakes that have zebra mussels, or that the percentage of lakes having zebra mussels is going, it's not increasing at this rate, it's increasing at this rate? Can you give us the measurable results we would expect?
Mr. Chair,
Colonel.
Representative Wagenius, yes, obviously the measurable outcome would be fewer violations, fewer infested waters, fewer impacted wetlands as well. Without the people in the field, obviously that's not going to happen. And because of the nature of the job, I can't guarantee that those will be the results of more people. But it makes sense that if you don't have the people out there to identify those impacts and to take action to prevent them or to stop them, that it will only increase.
Representative Wagenius.
Last question or last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with you on half of that. If you don't have the people out there, then you have you don't have a chance of having good outcomes. But if you have the people out there, that's necessarily a guarantee of good outcomes. So we need to know what measurable outcomes, what goals you're setting by having additional personnel. What measurable goals would you put on the table to say this is the reason that we should support a new academy? And I think we need to know that before we go ahead.
Well, Representative Wagenius, to that point, I think it's important to realize these are not actually additional. I would argue that these are replacing areas where, I know when I was duck hunting this fall, the CO was filling in out in Big Stone County. I can't remember exactly if he was the resident there and his territory had drastically expanded, or if he was kind of coming over to fill in for the CO that had recently retired. So these are backfilling positions that are currently vacant because of the aging state workforce. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Colonel Conrad, with your department undermanned or understaffed, do your people put in a lot of overtime? Are they on call 24/7, or what are the schedules like of your officers?
Colonel Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, They do have an allotment of overtime available to them to maintain that flexibility because we do not have the 24-hour-a-day coverage that a local police department or sheriff's department would have. So they have to be out there. Even on their days off, they have to have the ability to respond to calls that come into them and that sort of thing. They are limited right now at 400 hours straight time equivalent. And most of them utilize that to work special projects and also situations like working on holidays where, of course, the recreational activities are the highest because everybody else has the day off. We have to have those officers out there working during those high activity periods.
Thank you, Colonel. Colonel, to that point, aren't you an avid deer hunter?
Mr. Chair, no, I'm a bird hunter.
Okay, I apologize for mixing that up. And is it pheasants, ducks, or grouse?
All three, and recently took up some quail hunting in another state as well.
Well, unless you're down illegally hunting in Houston County, you aren't hunting quail in Minnesota. Colonel Conrad, to that point, how many opening days, you and I think are probably around the same generation, though I'm probably older than you, how many opening days of pheasants and ducks have you been out on since you've been a CO? Hunting, not checking on me.
Mr. Chair, I have not hunted on an opener since I became a CO.
Thank you, Colonel Conrad. Thank you for the service to the state. Any further questions? Okay. Mr. Meyer.
Thank you. This was a great conversation. And just one summary comment. Having a diverse workforce is very important to the department, and we will do whatever we can to make sure our next recruitment class reflects the demographics of the state as much as possible. So we'll get back to you on that. While Colonel Conrad is here, I just would like to cover our other change item related to the Enforcement Division, dealing with a change that took place last session. And this is somewhat related to our training, so I'll have Colonel Conrad just briefly talk about this as well, Mr. Chair.
Colonel.
Mr. Chair, this reflects an amount of money that has been deposited into the Game and Fish Fund into a section of that fund called the KT Surcharge Fund. It's funded by fees that are attached to fines for traffic and game and fish type violations. And to this point, we have, up until last year, we had no allotment of that money given to the Division of Enforcement. It's earmarked for to pay for conservation officer training. And last year, it had a balance of nearly $1 million in that fund. And a good $900,000 of that was taken and transferred to the general fund, and we were given an appropriation of $140,000 that went to enhancing our ability to train our officers in both mandated training and additional resource-based training. This proposal would give us an annual disbursement out of that fund of $135,000 that would be used in those years that we had an academy to help underwrite the costs of that academy, and in those years where there wasn't an academy to underwrite the costs of mandated training for our conservation officers to maintain their licensing.
Thank you. And again, Colonel, it's going to come from what account?
It would come from the Game and Fish Fund. There's a special sub-account in the Game and Fish Fund called the KT Surcharge, and that's where this money goes to, and it cannot be spent for anything other than conservation officer training.
Thank you, Colonel. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, now we will move into Ecological Resources and Waters, and while Director Hirsch is coming up, I'm just going to pull up a few slides that summarize the budget here, and then we're going to talk about invasive species surcharge. As I mentioned yesterday, these two divisions, Ecological Resources and Waters, have been recently combined. Here's the Waters budget of $47.1 million, of which 46%, or almost $22 million, comes from the general fund. You can see there's a variety of other sources there, clean water funding, which has been talked about in the Legacy Division, and we're working with Representative Torkelson on that funding bill. Federal funds, some LCCMR, Environmental Trust Fund dollars, and also just a small percentage of outdoor heritage funds. You can see the expenditures here, Mr. Chairman, and we spoke of those recently. The strategic objectives that we covered yesterday, inventory analysis and monitoring, conservation assistance and ecosystem management. One of the change items that we have, and I'll let Director Hirsch talk about this briefly, is a transfer of some dollars that go to the general fund into a dedicated account within the Natural Resources Fund for our water activities. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn this over to Director Hirsch.
Welcome, Director Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Hirsch, Director of Division of Ecological and Water Resources for DNR. Mr. Meyer said, the water management account change item would take the fees from water use, public water, and dam safety permits, which currently go into the general fund to the tune of about $5 million a year, and deposit them into a new account in the Natural Resources Fund. This would be a statutory appropriation that would be available for use as the revenues went in there. It's designed, as Mr. Meyer said, to be budget neutral. And the main advantage we see to this is that we'd be able to develop a dedicated funding source for water programs, which we haven't had up until this point. And this would allow us to, as we go into the future, make better decisions about how much funding we want to put into these programs and what the right cost of these permits should be.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no other questions on that, we're going to move into our invasive species prevention and management discussion here. This is probably the highest priority that we have within our budget. Hunting and fishing license fee increase is a high priority as well, but the threat in dealing with the prevention and controlling aquatic invasive species is paramount right now. If we don't get our hands around this problem this year, we may just lose the battle on the spread of these zebra mussels and things like that. So with that, Mr. Chairman, we've been working with a large stakeholder group. There's a lot of people out there who want to do a lot more than what we're doing, but we're trying to take a systematic approach on this. A big piece of it deals with funding that we're going to talk about today. We also have a policy bill that we're working on in the revisor's office that hopefully will be introduced next week that will deal with the authority of inspections, not mandated, but provide us some authority for cleaning boats and other issues related to invasive species on the policy side that we hope to get to you all very shortly as well. With that, I'll have Director Hirsch talk about the funding proposal.
Director Hirsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So currently our aquatic invasive species program is funded with a combination of general fund and invasive species account, which is the account that this change level deals with. And then this year we also have some federal funds. We've got about $1.7 million in general fund for the current fiscal year, about $2.1 million in invasive species account, and another $0.8 million in federal funds. And that's what our budget is currently. The invasive species account revenues are primarily from the watercraft license surcharge and then a non-resident fishing license surcharge. And the watercraft license surcharge is currently $5 for all watercraft and has not been changed since 1993. And the important thing to remember about the watercraft license is that it's good for 3 years. You don't get it every year, you get it every 3 years. And so essentially right now the watercraft license surcharge is causing boaters about $1.66 a year. The invasive species account has currently a structural deficit, which means the base appropriation exceeds the annual revenues. And because of this structural deficit, we project that this fund will be in the red by about $500,000 by the fiscal year 2013. And this actually has been the case ever since this fund was established for the 2008-2009 biennium. In 2008-2009, we addressed it by not spending our entire authorization. And then in the current biennium, it was addressed through one-time transfers from the water recreation account, about $725,000 each year to take care of that structural deficit.
Director Hirsch, Representative Quam, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, has there been, since the transport is the issue, has there been any consideration of having some sort of a surcharge on boat trailers or vehicles that convey, so that if you have a boat in your lake and you're not moving it anywhere, you're not going to be transporting, these invasive species. So to me, it would be logical that if you're going to gain fees, you'd be gaining it from the transport. And so if you could comment.
Director Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, we have discussed that. We did not decide to go in that direction. It has been discussed in that point that you brought up, that some people just keep their boat on one lake and they're less risk to spread. It's certainly a valid point that's been made. One complicating issue that doesn't preclude doing it with the licensing the trailers is the trailers fall into a larger class of utility trailers, so it's not just boat trailers. It's also trailers that pull snowmobiles, trailers that pull ATVs, any type of utility trailer, and those are licensed by the Department of Public Safety. So we have talked about that, but that's not the direction that we went with this proposal.
Mr. Chair, just to that point as well, Representative Quam, one of the other barriers that we face is that those licenses those trailers are now registered for the lifetime of the license. And that change really presents us with the challenge of how do you attach some kind of annual fee to that trailer. I know there's a lot of concern about that. I think it's a convenience point. The license plates are no longer on them, things of that nature. But going to that lifetime license structure for those trailers really prohibits us from actively putting on some kind of surcharge for those people.
Follow-up, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Commissioner, my thought is that you would have a sticker or emblem that you put on, just like when you go to parks, you've got something in your windshield. So that if you were transporting a watercraft and you were stopped by enforcement and you did not have the sticker, then you would have a fine, just like if you don't have the park pass and et cetera. To me, that doesn't seem as unusual of a solution.
Comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Meyer.
That's an interesting idea, and this is the question you brought up yesterday, put us to work for a while, and we're still trying to deal with that question. We will look at this idea and see if there is value to it. I mean, one of the things we've been struggling with is a sticker on the boat, for example, for invasive species. I need to check with enforcement. We need to just go through some things. Who would issue that kind of a sticker? DPS, the challenge we always have with the Department of Public Safety is the licensing system. Their computer upgrade is several years out still. That would allow us to do these types of things. But we will look into that and get back to you all on that. So.
And Representative Calm raises a good question, but I will also tell you, as being one of those folks that Representative Qualm is saying maybe wouldn't make sense for us, we have a large boat at the lake, and we don't own a trailer. But I've also been one that would advocate people that don't own a boat trailer because they're able to keep their boat on the lake all the time are very, very concerned about AIS. And Representative Qualm, I appreciate the discussion and the point. But in many cases, those are folks that absolutely have the ability and the wherewithal to also pay, and are the ones that we're hearing some of the loudest from that want to be part. So I don't want to let them off the hook on the other side of it. So Representative Qualm and I are coming at a problem from two different sides, but we both want it settled, and we want it somehow to find a fair solution in the end. Continue on. Director Hirsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So as I was saying, this proposal would eliminate the structural deficit in the invasive species account, and then it would raise an additional approximately $3.2 million in revenue in fiscal year 12 and another $4.4 million thereafter. And it would allow additional expenditures in the program of about $3.9 million in fiscal year 12 and then $4 million thereafter. So it would roughly more than double our current operating budget for aquatic invasive species. And so just to lay out what the increases would be, we're talking about right now the watercraft license surcharge is $5 for any boat, no matter what it is. So we're proposing a tiered system. There would be a $5 increase for a total of $10, and this does not include the issuing fee, these figures I'm giving you, but the table we passed out does. A $5 increase for canoes, kayaks, sailboats, sailboards, etc., for a $10 total. A $15 increase for boats under 17 feet for a $20 total, and then a $20 increase for other watercraft, which fall in a number of different categories, for a $25 total. And then we'd also be increasing the non-resident fishing license surcharge by $3. It's currently $2, so that would be a $5 total. And just to finish off, the main outcomes that we would get from this increased expenditures would be a doubling of enforcement hours. Currently, there's about 12,800 enforcement hours dedicated to AIS, aquatic invasive species, so we would be able to double that. We would increase our inspections of boats at high risk, particularly targeting high-risk areas, and we would also provide for more thorough inspections than we've done in the past. We would provide some additional infrastructure for decontamination stations that could be set up in conjunction with our inspections in high-risk areas. We would also have increased grant dollars for control of invasive aquatic plants on lakes. We're currently able to fund about 50 lakes roughly, and this would allow us to add an additional 60 lakes for invasive aquatic plant control. This is primarily milfoil and curly leaf pondweed control. And then it would allow us to increase our public awareness efforts both on a local and statewide basis, and then also would provide for a program to license and train lake service providers, people that install docks, boat lifts, and that sort of thing. So that's the summary for this change item.
Director Hirsch, I have a couple of questions. Would we get either a certification or a registration program for boat, lift, dock folks prior to the coming season?
Mr. Chairman, that piece is going to be in our policy legislation. I'm not sure if we could get it fully implemented by this coming season. We would certainly try to get a good start on it. But one of the big things we're going to have to do first is, you know, notify and identify who they are, because this has not been a licensed activity before. So just corralling everybody. We would certainly make a start on it, but I don't think we would get, we may not be able to get, I should say, full implementation this year. We would certainly try as much as we could.
I'll let it go at that. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, you commented briefly on the proposed legislation you're having worked on now. And if I misheard you, I apologize, but I think you mentioned that inspection would not be mandatory. Well, can't somebody just say, no thanks, you can't look at my boat or inspect my boat if it's not mandatory?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, what we're looking for is the authority to have that mandatory inspection. It's going to be an interesting conversation for us to have, not only in this committee, but in Representative Cornish's committee as well, because that is something that some people probably aren't going to like. But we need to have that. In order to be effective, we need to be able to have the authority to check somebody's live well, to check their bilge, make sure that they aren't moving a lot of contaminated water, for example, making sure that their bait buckets are drained properly. It's going to be a conversation that we have to have, and I hope we can have your support on that.
Thank you. Any other questions in this regard? Mr. Hirsch, Director Hirsch, I had one more. Will we see some of the decontamination, I guess I'll call them facilities for lack of a better term, this summer?
Mr. Chairman, I think we would try to get some in place by this summer. The thing with decontamination facilities is you have to find a good location for them. Many of our accesses were not designed for decontamination facilities, so if we can't put them at an access, we have to find some other location that's strategically located where people are getting up to an access. So that's the hurdle we have to come, but the goal would be to try to get some of these in the high-risk areas yet this year. And we actually have some dollars in our budget right now that we could put towards that. So.
Thank you for your efforts, Director Hirsch. We do need to put it on a fast track.
Mr. Chairman, we will be talking about that proposal specifically when we talk about a water rec change item as well. While I do have Director Hirsch here with me, I'd like to have him talk about our aquatic plant management change item that's within the budget. This deals with an area of the DNR budget that is being supported by general fund, and the permit fees do not fully pay the costs that are associated with the program. So I'll have Director Hirsch talk about that as well.
Director Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman, so this change level, maybe I should start off just by giving everybody a brief description of this program. The Aquatic Plant Management Permit Program allows lakeshore owners to control aquatic plants for landowner access to open water, and the idea behind the program is that we allow riparian access but still protect the habitat and water quality benefits of aquatic plants. In 2008, the legislature directed the DNR to recover the full cost of the program in terms of permit administration and enforcement through the permit fees, and they directed us to do this by rulemaking. And currently, The annual permit revenues bring in about $300,000, but the full cost of this program is about $1 million a year for the department, and this cost is not in the divisions of Fish and Wildlife, the Division of Enforcement, and then the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. And it's being currently subsidized by general fund, as Mr. Meyer said, but also by other revenue sources to the water recreation account, as well as some game and fish fund. And the proposal, in order to meet the legislative directive, we had to roughly triple the fees, because we're only bringing in $300,000 and we needed to bring in $1 million. So we went through the rulemaking process on this as directed, and we actually went through the hearings. An administrative law judge recommended approval, but the previous governor's office would not approve. So where we're sitting right now is, if we were going to redo these rules, we'd have to start over. So our proposal is to increase these fees through legislative action to be able to comply with the legislative mandate.
Director Hirsch, for the committee's benefit, can you give a snapshot of what this permit is allowing the lakeshore owners to do?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Basically, you know, there's some aquatic plant control that you can do without a permit. You can mechanically control submerged aquatic plants up to 2,500 square feet without a permit. Any control of emergent aquatic plants, any control utilizing pesticides, any mechanical control that exceeds this 2,500 square foot area, and then any control using the device that's commonly known as a weed roller requires a permit. And then these permits are applied for by individual lake owners, sometimes in groups of lakeshore owners, in order to be able to get access to open water. And so that's essentially what the program does. We have about 4,500 permits that we issue every year.
Director Hirsch, did I hear you say that weed rollers do require a permit, and do we charge a fee for that permit?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The weed rollers do require a permit, and we charge, I think it's the same fee as for the others. I think there's a provision that allows the permit to be good for 3 years, but I believe the fee is still paid every year, or the equivalent of a three-year fee. So,
Director Hirsch, is that permit affixed to the weed roller where we can see it?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. The permit requires that there be a sticker affixed to the weed roller.
Thank you, Director. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, I noticed the budget says $700,000. You were mentioning $100,000 in cost. And I'm wondering, you know, when you mentioned enforcement and et cetera, the people doing the enforcement are probably already on the lake enforcing other regulations. So how are you accounting for 30% discrepancy between the $700,000 shown on the budget here and the $1 million you were discussing?
Director Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Qualm, it is true that some of the enforcement may be happenstance when an enforcement officer happens to be out on the lake, but we also have, I think it's, and Director Conrad could correct me if I'm wrong, I think we have 8 enforcement officers statewide that focus on aquatic plant regulations, wetland regulations, and aquatic invasive species regulations, and so I would guess that a lot of the cost, enforcement cost, is in those positions.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, continue.
Mr. Chairman, if there's no other questions, we have one other change item within ecological resources and waters that we'll talk about here, and then I'll pull us back to the general discussion, and I think we're probably almost ahead of the game in my mind where I thought we would be today, so we can talk about that after this. So,
okay.
We're doing really well. So,
Mr. Meyer, to that point then, Director Hirsch, you've talked about this policy bill on AIS. I don't consider that to necessarily just be a policy bill. We've gotten instructions from our Ways and Means Chair that policy bills that have fiscal implications need to be considered to be fiscal bills in nature. We talked a few weeks ago about the need to be working double time on this AIS issue, so I'm hopeful that we can see that bill shortly, so we'll be able to move it in the right direction, and I'm hopeful that it'll have an effective day after enactment, because we're going to need to be working on this issue, and I realize we may not be able to get some of this stuff done prior to this season, but we need to
even if the certifications and licensing or whatever it is for the folks with the docks and lifts, we can be having communications with them prior to break up this spring.
Mr. Chair, that is our top priority right now. At least my priority is getting that bill jacketed and in your hands as soon as possible. And we will make sure that those changes you mentioned are in that legislation as well.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Continue.
Mr. Chairman, the last change item for the division is an increase in request from the water recreation account of $500,000 a year. And this will be to provide funding for work that we do on water level and at stream level gauging, and also providing technical support for local government units. This is a part of the program on the hydrologic programs that's really been affected by general fund cuts over the last decade, and it's hampered our ability to provide some of the hydrologic support that our area hydrologists need when they're working with local units of government, and also to provide some of this critical lake level and stream level information. It's used for a lot of different things. It's used for recreation. It's used to help with water quality and water quantity monitoring. It's also used to help with flood prediction. So this is very important work that's we've been seeing decreases in over the last decade, and we think this would be a good use of water recreation account dollars to help bolster this activity.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. We've been kind of jumping around in our proposal here, but I'm going to try to get us back on track a little bit if I can. And I want to talk about just a couple things that are there that are not going to be dealt with within this division, but I'm trying to find the slides. And our legacy programs are in your presentation, but those dollars are going to be dealt with within Representative Erdahl's committee. So our clean water proposal, the slides that we have are in your presentation. I'm not going to go through those right now, but let you know that information is there. Our parks and trails proposal that we have within the governor's budget does fairly follow the proposal that was presented in 2 years ago in the budget, roughly 43% for state parks, 43% for metro parks, and then 16% for parks and trails of regional or statewide significance. That grant program, that third pot of money, the 16%, is open for metropolitan and regional parks, but not eligible for the Department of Natural Resources. There was some confusion about that as the budget rolled out and some of the documents supporting the budget rolled out, but I wanted to make sure people were aware of that, as and we will clarify that position in the legacy division as well, Mr. Chairman. With that, we're on the forestry division change items right now, and we've completed ecological resource change items, our general fund change items. So I'm just going to keep moving through your presentation, Mr. Chairman, and talking about our forestry change items, and then we will continue wherever we leave off and go forward from there if you so desire.
Mr. Meyer, you have the Fish and Wildlife folks here today, and I'm not sure that they'll be here after today. You have a proposal within forestry or with that you're going to move some currently there's forestry operations happening on some Fish and Wildlife area, and you're going to move a pretty big chunk of money to can we have that part of your presentation today while those folks also happen to be here? And if it centers around Mr. Epperly or the forestry folks, I'm assuming they'll be here tomorrow. Was that the plan, or were you doing forestry?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to cover the forestry
That's
piece,
fine.
But the provision you're talking about, I think we've discussed within the general fund change item, that cost certification process that will be occurring now for our forestry activities on the wildlife management areas and also within our parks and trails and scientific and natural areas. I don't have any more information on that. Certainly we could bring up Director Bogus if you do have questions for him on some of the impacts of that proposal since he is here. Or we could also talk about the fish and wildlife change item since Mr. Bogus is here as well.
No, I forgot actually, Mr. Meyer, that we had a thorough discussion on that. Representative Wagenius, did you have, okay, sorry. Mr. Meyer, if we're done, we can quit early, actually. But if you got more, we'll keep going.
Well, I was wondering, if rather than go into the forestry piece and then stop in 10 minutes and move forward, it might make sense just to pause our presentation here and pick this up when we meet again. And just to talk about where we're at, we have forestry to go through, parks and trails change items, and then We talked about the enforcement, fish and wildlife, and ecological resources and waters division. So I think on our change item presentation, Mr. Chairman, we're past halfway, and okay. Then the controversial ones are the big ones. I shouldn't say controversial. The bigger items that we have are out there.
Excuse me, Mr. Meyer. Representative Torkelson, did you want to move the minutes?
I did want to move the minutes, sir.
Discussion to the minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, why don't we try to do this real quick, since I do have Mr. Bogus here with me. Let me bring up...
Mr. Meyer, we were excited to leave early.
Okay, we can do that,
then. No, no. Mr. Bogus, come down. Thank you. Doggone it. Miss Martinson, what did she do to you? Doggone it.
As possible. We just have several change items that we can talk about. The first one here, Mr. Chairman, deals with the Lamprey Pass Wildlife Management Area, and this was some language that was caught up in a bill last year as well. We sold an easement to Washington County for a new bridge up by Forest Lake by the Lamprey Pass WMA. All we're asking for is that those dollars be deposited into an account to allow us to buy replacement land that we sold for that bridge. So this is a $600,000 appropriation from to be deposited into the Game and Fish Fund. No, the dollars are already there, Mr. Chairman. The next change item just deals with adjusting the accounts that we have. Our Game and Fish stamp accounts are biennial appropriations that are currently fixed. So we're appropriating dollars that we think we have on these accounts, and we have to come back and adjust them on a biennial basis. What we're asking for is that we make these appropriations statutorily be appropriated to the commissioner each year so we can manage the accounts like a bank account would be, with the amount of money that's in there. For example, when we sell more pheasant stamps in 1 year than we thought we would, that we would be able to use those dollars for the habitat work. Or if we sell less, there would be less money available. This proposal, and in our language in the governor's budget bill, we will have adjustments to many of these accounts, either on the positive side or the negative side, depending on the balances and how those appropriations has occurred. So you can see here it's a net, or I should say, well, yeah, the net is $528,000 reduction out of those individual accounts. And the fact sheets that you have in your packets will clearly identify what those changes are. The other one, Mr. Chairman, that we spoke of is a general fund appropriation. This is really the only new general fund appropriation for the department, and it deals with our fish, our wildlife health work, bovine TB and chronic wasting disease in deer, avian influenza and Newcastle disease in wild birds, and other health issues are something we're dealing with on a more prevalent basis. And this funding change item would allow continued funding for the monitoring and management of these wildlife health issues. You can see some of the outcomes that are listed there. Continuing our cooperative efforts with the Board of Animal Health, Department of Ag, and the United States Department of Agriculture on TB work. And also it will help fund our CWD avian influenza and the Newcastle disease virus work that we're doing as well. And Director Boggs, let's see if there's any questions on that, Mr. Chair. All right, now I'm done for the day. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we're actually doing pretty good as far as keeping on track. You're asking lots of good questions, but paying attention, and I appreciate that. And I got to let members know that I don't wear my jacket in the room here lots of times, but I will say I hope somebody in this big building is listening, because some people are freezing. So hopefully we can find out. I see Representative Scott and Miss Rudolph shivering, so hopefully we can figure out, or we're going to have to get some blankets or something. Members, anything else? For right now, members, we are not going to consider any evenings. We're doing well. We're going to keep plugging along, because evenings are going to become a part of life sooner than many of us want, so I'm not going to push for it to happen any sooner. Thanks for the cooperation. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question when you both are still up there. We've talked about, this is back on the hunting and fishing licenses again, and we've heard talk about non-resident, but the one that jumps out at me is the angling combination, husband, wife, and kids, $25 to $40. That's a 60% increase. That's pretty hefty for a resident fishing license.
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, and Mr. Meckel might have a little more background on the market research on that, but that was a pretty heavily discounted license before, and so we're thinking that we probably were underpricing it previously, and that this is a fee that we think is more appropriate for what types of licensing options are being achieved with that license. Having said that, we really are interested in youth and family, you know, participation, but we think based on our research that this is still a reasonable price that will still make this an attractive license for families.
Representative Anderson, follow up. I know you represent the southernmost glacial lake in the state of Minnesota. Even though you're a farmer yourself and represent a lot of farm country, you have Minnewaska in your district, and the amount or number of fishing boats on that lake is phenomenal at different times of the year, and the ice houses. I happen to drive by it on our way to our pheasant land. With that, members, we're adjourned.